This is the IBJ podcast for the week of March 11th, 2024, brought to you by Taft. I'm your host, Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. When serial entrepreneur Christopher Day walks into a room, he should be followed by somebody with a boombox playing Start Me Up by the Rolling Stones. Not to put too fine a point on it, but Christopher Day gathers no moss. Over the last 30 years, he has co-founded 8 businesses in 7 distinct sectors, namely artificial intelligence, software as a service, hard tech, broadband, entertainment, investment banking, and real estate. For the last 2 years, he has been CEO of Indianapolis-based Elevate Ventures, a seed and early-stage venture capital firm that invests in high-potential, innovation-based companies with a significant presence in Indiana. And last year, Elevate launched Rally, a 3-day innovation conference in Indianapolis that brought together hundreds of companies, entrepreneurs, universities, and investors from a broad range of industries, and included a pitch competition with $5 million in prizes. With his decades of experience and different roles in the entrepreneurial ecosystem, Day has a unique vantage point on Indiana's startup community, its strengths, and its weaknesses. He recently served as a panelist at IBJ's Technology Power Breakfast, and I wanted to follow up with him on several points he made about expanding recruitment of talent, the untapped power of collaboration and transparency, and the 5 key aspects of a business where entrepreneurs can minimize risk and get buy-in from investors. He also shares some high-level thoughts about Elevate's plans to relocate from northern Indianapolis to downtown's Miles Square. Here's our conversation. It's my pleasure to welcome to the podcast Christopher Day, a serial entrepreneur over the last 30 years, and for almost the last 2 years, CEO of Elevate Ventures. Thank you, Chris, for making time. Drop by the studio today, and I will, from here on out, call you Toph.
Sounds great, Mason. Great to be here. I'm excited.
I don't know if you've looked at your LinkedIn page recently. It's sort of unintentionally funny. We do lots of interviews on the podcast with company founders and CEOs. On your LinkedIn profile, you were listed as the co-founder of 4 companies, 3 of which you were the CEO, the 4th as managing partner.
Yep.
And I know how it is with LinkedIn pages. Sometimes they're not totally complete, but it's just interesting. Not only were you the co-founder of all these companies, but it wasn't like all the same kind of company. It wasn't like you were doing, you know, cloud computing here and then you did something related to cloud computing here. They're all different kinds of companies. Can you like kind of run through that real quick?
It wasn't by design, but I guess I grew up on a small farm and I was always just curious about how the outside world worked. And so developed relationships over the years. And the first company I ever started was a painting company, and that was a means to an end, right? I had to pay for college and get through college. I thought I wanted to do commercial construction. I wanted to have my own general contracting company originally. And I found out that I actually didn't want to do that. I wanted to be a commercial developer. And so the first tech company that I started was a broadband company and was again a means to an end. I wanted to go try to grow a company, make some money so I could be a commercial developer. I just never got back. And so that kind of set off a string of various types of tech companies, or that one was an investment banking firm, got into family entertainment businesses kind of on the side as a, I took a lot of passion in offering a first job to kids in high school or college. So it just took on a path of its own. And I always say you should definitely love your business, but not be in love with it. Because if you're in love with your business, you can make bad decisions. And so it wasn't by design, but kind of the rough average life cycle of those businesses was probably 4 or 5 years. And then someone would come along and want to buy that business. And so we would go ahead and exit if it made sense, or cashed out to partners or various things along the way. But it's been quite an interesting ride.
How many of your businesses have been acquired?
Almost all of them. Probably out of those 8, probably 5. I have to go think through them real quick, but probably 5 of them were acquired or cashed out. You know, the painting company, I basically sold the painting assets off to somebody else. But the others, you know, there was an exit to Motorola. There was one to Comcast, National Water and Power, one cashed out to partners, et cetera. So
when you're starting those businesses, are you thinking already about the exit?
Like, you know, I need to build something that's useful to people, but also that is going to be attractive to another company.
I think it's one of the most critical questions that founders need to ask themselves, and they don't enough. And so when you're starting a business, I think you need to think through, do I want a lifestyle business? Am I going to exit to a strategic, right? Because people always say, well, an exit possibility is an IPO. Well, very few companies actually exit through an IPO. And in fact, the IPO doesn't typically give the highest return to the founder or the investors. Strategic exits are typically the biggest return for any founder. But I think this idea of lifestyle versus selling to strategic is critical. Like, how do you want to grow your business? How fast do you want to grow? Do you want to be reliant or have to march to the beat of a board? Like, these are really big questions. And I want to touch on this lifestyle comment for a moment, because I've talked with some entrepreneurs before when I ask them this very question, because it becomes obvious in the conversation that they haven't really thought about how they envision like their contribution to the business and how they want that to manifest itself. And I use the term, have you thought about, do you want a lifestyle business or do you really want to raise venture capital? Because once you get on that hamster wheel, you're not getting off. You just got to go faster, faster, faster. And the entrepreneur took exception to this concept of a lifestyle business, thinking that meant small or not relevant. I have friends that have lifestyle businesses that are doing $300-$500 million in revenue. And so lifestyle business just means you stay in control every step of the way. You might grow slower, but more intentionally, more methodically. And it can be a wonderful outcome. It doesn't mean small or not relevant. It's just a different way of growing a business.
It just means you're not taking on so many investors or
ceding
control of the company to board members to the point where, I mean, it just, you can't do what you want to do.
That's right. I mean, at some point, if you take on venture capital, then you're at risk of being fired by the board. So do you want that risk or not? Right. And neither one's right or wrong. It's just a different way of growing a business.
Now, how did you do it?
I've done it both ways. So I've raised venture capital in various businesses, had boards, and I've also grown businesses organically. And I've also self-funded businesses where it took no outside capital. Maybe I had one partner, you know, who was a partner in the business, or two partners where we self-funded the business and had no other outside capital.
Is there one that you ended up preferring?
You know, I think they're all different. The family entertainment business, for example, it was me and a partner, and we self-funded that and got some bank financing. It was awesome. We had a blast running that business. We actually brought someone in to run the business for us day to day. It was wonderful. If you're in an innovative business in tech or high tech, or you're in a highly regulated business, so med device or med tech or pharma, or you're doing something with artificial intelligence, you almost don't have a choice but to raise outside capital. Because typically whatever you're doing, whether people think they have competitors, everybody has a competitor. And in some businesses, you might have 3 competitors or you might have 100 competitors. And if your competitors are raising $10, $50, $100 million from venture capital, they're going to be able to go much faster than you. And so in those innovative driven businesses, most oftentimes there's no choice but to raise outside capital.
Oh, so going back to my original question, why didn't you just stay in the same industry over and over? I mean, if somebody gave me $100 million and said, okay, you get to keep 50. Now take the other 50 and start 4 businesses. I guarantee you they all would be in media. I mean, because that's just what I know.
Yep.
I mean, and barely.
Yeah. So there's a very direct linkage, and it's all based on relationships of how all those businesses started. So for any one of those businesses, I probably thought about doing 100 other things before actually moving forward with one. So the very first business, the painting company, the way that came about is one of my older brothers had a roommate in college, and they had both graduated from IU and were living in Chicago. And my brother knew that I always wanted to own my own business, initially commercial general contracting. His roommate in Chicago had a painting company in high school and maybe even into college, and he made great money doing that. And so my brother said, hey, my roommate and I will put up $10,000. If you want to start a painting company, you come up to Chicago and you start a painting company and you'll be able to fund yourself through college. That's why I did it. That's where the idea came from. I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur someday, cut my teeth. Here's $10,000. And we split the company to thirds. I did 100% of the work. Well, 99%. But that's how that started. Did that for 3 years and graduated from college with very little debt. So then after college, I went to Atlanta for about 5 years doing commercial construction, some commercial development things. And when I came back to Indianapolis for the purpose of starting another business to get into, I discovered I wanted to be in commercial development. And so I came back here. This is where my relationships were. one of the guys I had that painting company with, the third partner called and said, I heard you're back in town. I've got this idea I've been working on. Well, next thing I know, we start this broadband company. And that was the means to an end to ultimately be a commercial developer. We do the broadband company. We sell that to Comcast. And I was going to go start a commercial development company, which I did do. And we did like four commercial developments. But one of our old customers called up and said, I've got these utility problems. Will you help me solve them? Well, initially I said, no. Long story short, my partner and I decided to start another business to help this particular old customer out. And we got into automated meter reading and built, you know, devices ultimately to serve municipalities and apartment communities and manufactured housing. And then we discovered the utility industry needed a billing software. So we started a billing software. Another friend called and they had some help and needed some help in bottled water. So we did that. Sold all of those things off. So it was four companies in 10 years, had sold all those off. I needed a break. It was going to take 2 years off. That lasted 90 days. I felt irrelevant, out of the mode of conversations. And my older brother called up and said, let's go buy a business together. That's where things were a little wonky in Wall Street at the time. You know, market was crashing. And so we looked at buying several different types of businesses. And then the conversation came back to, you know what? I've watched how you grow your businesses in the middle quarter of the U.S. for a number of years. There's a lot of great companies that need served with investment banking out here. How about we start an investment banking firm and go focus on the middle quarter of the U.S.? So that's how that business started. Along the way, one of my old entrepreneurial friends called and said, hey, I see busloads of kids going to these trampoline parks. And I looked at that as diversification of capital / also passionate about kids. I had a lot of help with each of these businesses, people who gave me experience sharing or advice, things of that nature. So that's how we started the Sky Zone franchises that we did. And then what I do after that, I don't even remember. And then that all led into all those experiences. I was always frustrated with marketing. And so we ultimately started an artificial intelligence data-driven company for serving the marketing world. So they were all relationship-driven decisions where we would add value. Somebody would want to buy one of them. We would sell them, roll into the next thing based off of customer demands or relationships.
Yeah, so I see two through lines. One is, yeah, the relationships and being open to relationships.
Yes.
And, you know, and allying yourself with competent people.
Yes.
But also solving problems.
Like, that's right.
The classic reason for starting a business is to solve a specific need.
Which gets overlooked a lot of times, right? Sometimes people have a hammer looking for a nail, right? And so, like, if you start off with true pain and validate, you know, is there at least one or two or three people you know in network that would buy that solution to solve that pain, then you know you have something you can build from there.
Now, explain to us how you ended up at Elevate, which is a different animal. And maybe what we need to do first is explain, and in a way that I can understand it.
Yep.
So like, maybe like you're talking to your 8-year-old son. What is Elevate Ventures? It does a few things. What does it do?
So Elevate Ventures is both a venture capital and venture development firm. What that means is we invest money into innovation-driven enterprises. Kauffman Foundation talks about the tale of two entrepreneurs, SMEs and IDEs. SMEs are small and medium-sized enterprises. So that's your hair salon, your restaurant, maybe a pure play services business. It's typically something with more of a local customer base, 30, 60 mile type of a customer base. Innovation-driven enterprises, the biggest differentiator that I always use is it has a $500 million TAM. So TAM stands for total addressable market. So they have a customer base that's national or global in potential that they can sell this solution to over and over again. So those are innovation-driven enterprises. That's what Elevate Ventures invests in. So those could be software companies, hard tech companies, healthcare companies, life sciences, med tech, med device, ag biosciences, food tech, sports tech, anything that is innovation-driven or even technology-enabled. That's what we invest in. A couple other sectors we don't invest in would be like real estate or oil and gas. So anything that's innovation-driven, we invest in the pre-seed, seed, and Series A stages. And what that means is pre-seed is pre-rev. Someone has an idea, they have a great background in something, they've demonstrated that they have competence, that they have a network where they can hire the other skill sets they need, whether that's sales or technical or whatever it might be. But at the pre-seed stage, you're typically talking no revenue, it's an idea, identified pain point, here's a proposed solution, and I need $50,000, $100,000, $300,000, $500,000 to kind of prove this initial thing out.
Yeah. This is what I think of as like the I'm starting a company in my garage.
That's right.
Level, yeah.
100%. That's exactly right. They don't have an office. They don't have anything. They might still be working full-time somewhere at a business.
Yeah, for sure.
Right. And then, or they could be a student in a dorm room or all in between. And then at the seed stage, the company typically has $100,000 or so in revenue, maybe several hundred thousand dollars in revenue. Now they need $500,000 or $1 or $2 or $3 million to kind of take it to the next stage. And then Series A, they typically have $2 or $3 million in revenue. And now they're looking to raise $5 or $10 million. And then so on and so forth. So at the pre-seed stage, you're often looking at who's the founder, right? Yeah. That's what you're investing in is right. Purely the founder. I mean, a little bit the idea, but not really, because a lot of companies fail at that stage. In the second stage, you're looking at an MVP, right? Right. They have minimum viable product that they're in market. They have a customer identified. When you get into Series A, you have absolute product market fit. And now it's time to start replicating the sales process.
So here's where I'm really good fuzzy. Elevate is a not-for-profit. Is that correct?
No.
It is not.
So I like to use the words, Elevate is just like any other venture capital firm that happens to have one major LP. So we are a tax-exempt organization. I use those words very intentionally because we are only a tax-exempt organization because of the nature of how we're structured. That we have a professional services agreement with the IEDC. So think of the IEDC.
Okay, you need to tell people who IEDC is, yeah.
So Elevate Ventures, think of Elevate Ventures just like any other venture capital or venture development firm. The biggest difference is we have one major LP.
And LP is what?
And an LP is a limited partner. So in a typical venture capital, they'll have, 50 limited partners. So these are people, institutions, family offices, whatever it may be, that will invest $5 million into a $100 million fund. In our situation, the Indiana Economic Development Corporation is in essence our LP. And sometimes they refer to it as, they think of Elevate as managing the state sovereign wealth fund.
Right. And IEDC is kind of a quasi-governmental, as they say,
that's right.
organization. I mean, it exists to serve the government's interests, the state's interests specifically.
The state's interest. Yeah. That's right. And it was set up under the Daniels administration to really focus on major projects that could really advance the state of Indiana on multiple fronts in and around economic development. And so those dollars are both state dollars and also federal dollars from a program that's called SSBCI. So those dollars flow into the IEDC, the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, and then through a professional services agreement, we invest those dollars from Elevate Ventures' side. But Elevate Ventures is a totally standalone entity. We have our own board that's totally separate from the state. It was set up intentionally that way because the private sector likes to work with the private sector. Right? Speed, efficiency, et cetera. Indiana was brilliant in how this was set up. It might be one of the greatest success stories of public-private partnership of all time. And what I mean by that is, and an example of that is, and maybe I should mention, Elevate does manage, we do manage a couple of other smaller funds that are your typical kind of 2 and 20 type funds. But the main thrust of the organization today is through that, the IEDC relationship. The impact that Elevate has had on the state of Indiana over the 13 years of its existence is $9.5 billion. So we manage $225 million today. It's an evergreen fund, right? So we invest in companies, those companies grow up, they sell. When those return dollars come in, we reinvest those dollars over time.
So there is an ownership interest.
Yes.
Elevate gets by investing in these companies.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
But then what you do is you just take that money, turn it around and reinvest it.
That's right.
In other companies that you think is earn the state's best interest.
That's exactly right. Yep. Yeah. So we invest in those cross-sector companies at one of those pre-seed seed Series A stages. And the checks that we write are anywhere between $20,000 and $2 million in any one given round or up to $4 million in a given company. So the farther they are along the life cycle of revenue growth and product market fit, then the larger check that they would be eligible for at a seed stage or at a Series A stage. The velocity is insane. We've made over 600 investments in 13 years. Almost 400 of those portcos are still active today. So we've had some exits as well. The co-investment with over 2,900 other venture capital firms across the globe have co-invested in these companies over time.
Oh, this is a situation where LA would just be one of several
that's right.
companies or as they would say, investors. lead a round
that's
yeah,
right.
of investors, for
that's
example.
Right.
So it's not just you.
Yeah, there might be two investors or six investors that invest right. in any given round. And so the co-investment of that 170 of the $171 million that we have in market, the co-investment of that is $2.3 billion. That's almost a 13 to 1 leverage ratio, which is amazing. We have our Portco payroll on an annual basis is over 500 million. We drive about—
That's the payroll of the companies that you've invested in.
Correct. That's right. We drive back to the state in terms of sales tax and income tax, nearly $35 million a year. So if you put, looked at on a run rate from a typical fund basis over 10 years, that's $350 million. The direct jobs that we've created, nearly 9,000 direct jobs. And if you look at the lowest multipliers we can find to be conservative, the lowest multipliers for indirect jobs is over 50,000 jobs that we've powered. If you look at the cost per job from an investment standpoint, this is the best thing you could ever do from an economic development standpoint. We're talking about a little over $5,000 in investment per job and roughly $600 for indirect jobs. It is by far the most powerful economic development tool that exists.
So real quick, we know your job title, but what do you personally do on a day-to-day basis?
So on a day-to-day basis, I look at it that I have 6 million stakeholders. Right? Every citizen in Indiana is a stakeholder, is the way I think about it. And so on a day-to-day basis, I am interacting at the legislative level, right? So whether that's the state government, whether that's local governments, I interact with other VCs, right? Other managing partners of other VCs. I interact with leaders of economic development groups in various cities around the state. I interact with entrepreneurs. I do podcasts to spread the gospel about best practices.
Isn't that a waste of time?
it's really powerful, right, to get the message out there. One of the things we're going to be diving deeper into are real takeaway value things where we see gaps in the entrepreneurial ecosystem. Examples of that would be legal hygiene, financial hygiene, specificity of go-to-market strategy. Like, there's very specific things where our entrepreneurial ecosystem— and I'm not talking about just the state of Indiana, by the way. I see this across the region, across the nation. But angel investors need to be educated on how to invest, because we see them requiring things of early stage companies before, if we've not invested yet, and they put the companies at risk of not being fundable in the next stage. So that's what I do on a day-to-day basis. I'm meeting with leaders across various facets of the innovation ecosystem to, number one, make sure they know who Elevate is, how to interact with Elevate, how to on-ramp or onboard with Elevate, to get in the process of potential funding, and then also preparing for the future. So today we manage $225 million. Our BHAG is in 10 years. We should be managing $1 billion. And that would come through an additional family of funds to focus on, for example, growth equity. So there's an export we have in Indiana. It's one of our biggest exports, and it's silent, and it's called wealth. So we take all the risk in Indiana. And this is other investors. Other investors in Elevate historically have invested in pre-seed, seed, series A. When the winners of the winners of the winners pop out, and now they're ready for a series B round of financing, and those are typically $20, $50, $100 million, our wonderful friends from across the country or across the globe come in and write those checks. That's where the risk-adjusted returns are. And so when we have our companies that exit for $100, $500 million, $1 billion, $2 billion, $3 billion, which happens, well over 90% of that wealth generation gets exported to the coasts and gets recycled in other cities and other states. We need to participate in a more significant way in those rounds, which is our plan.
Which is, yeah. This is your plan going forward.
Yes.
So even more than you do now.
Yes.
Okay. As Elevate.
Yes.
Okay. How are you going to do that?
So we would do that through launching a family of funds that would focus on very specific things. And so some of this, we still got to figure out how that's going to map out and how we respond to the market. But step one is a growth equity fund. Indiana has never had a growth equity fund. It is a no-brainer. We have people inbounding saying, we want you to start this growth equity fund. We're ready to go to write a check. And so it's a matter of standing that up. And that would be a $100 million fund at minimum. And that would be focusing on cross-sector Series B rounds.
Okay.
The next step would be, we have inbounds from people that are interested in doing a healthcare fund or an ag fund or a sports tech fund. And so we would just look at following the market for what it's ready for. And so that could either manifest itself in standing up another Series A fun to participate with our other Series A VCs here in Indiana. So like Ground Game, they'll do seed, Series Seed and Series A, a great new fund here in Indiana. Allos, who's been around for a long time, or High Alpha, right? We have some other wonderful VCs. And when you can get 3, 4, 5 VC checks around the table, especially at a Series A level company, that's really powerful because sometimes those companies will hit a hiccup and they might need a bridge round. And so having the capability for everybody to be able to chip in a little bit of money to get that company to the, you know, through that next phase into Series B is critical.
The capital would still be public capital?
No. That would be a mix of, we would layer in, we would leverage private sector capital.
Oh, okay. All right. Wow. That sounds like a significant thing.
It's very significant. Like this is a major
significant change.
It's a significant change, but it's a necessary change. And we must get started on it now because other states are doing it. Ohio's doing it. Pennsylvania's doing it. And other states are starting to stand up these additional funds. And we're ready to go. We have been ready to go. And we need to get started.
Okay, let's take a quick break so we can hear from our sponsor. This is the IVJ Podcast.
Taft, today's modern law firm. With more than 800 attorneys in 8 primary Midwest markets and the District of Columbia, we provide solutions to the business issues facing middle market and emerging companies alike. We do this through a highly collaborative and inclusive team approach. Taft, the modern law firm. To learn more, visit taftlaw.com.
All right, we're back with this week's edition of the IBJ Podcast in my interview with Christopher Day, CEO of Elevate Ventures, about the needs of Indiana's startup community.
One of the things that you mentioned at our recent Tech Power Breakfast, again, something you said you could spend an hour on, is what we can do or what we need to do better as a state with our entrepreneurship ecosystem. And I think specifically you said we need to do a better job, be more collaborative and more transparent. Yes. What did you mean by that?
Yes. So to really power forward this innovation ecosystem across the state, there's a few things that come top of mind. One is to be transparent and share how that world works. And so what I mean by that is we just had a deal the other day. An angel investor invested in a company, and that angel investor's background was in real estate, and they were investing in a B2B SaaS company. And they invested a significant amount of money, but they put a requirement in those investment terms that it would get a 2.5x pref return, and that also at the next stage of capital, it would get, I think it was like 50% of that capital paid back out to them. That just made that company not investable in the next round. It instilled certain doom. If that company would ever have to raise more money from investors, it will never happen. And what will happen in that situation is that company will go out, let's say they didn't ever talk to Elevate. They would go talk to either other angel investors that would look at those terms and go, well, I want that too, right? Or they go try to talk to venture capital firms, what they had started to do, and the venture capital firms won't even say anything. They'll just go silent. And this company has an interesting technology. I think it's got real opportunity. So Elevate, and I've never known how to be anything other than transparent. And people who are always transparent with me added me the most value. So we tell these entrepreneurs, you are unfundable because of these reasons. Here's how you can fix it. Let us help you fix this. And what often happens in these situations is they're like, well, then we don't want your money. And we say, okay. And pretty much every time, about 3 months later, they come back and say, can we talk again? And so we want to proactively help the entrepreneur. I want every single one of these entrepreneurs to be a billionaire. That's the goal. Because if they become a billionaire, everybody else wins. We've created more jobs. We've created high-paying jobs. We've created more wealth to recycle in the ecosystem. The list goes on. So what I find, though, is, and I don't blame these other VCs, by the way, for not being transparent. I get it. Sometimes people are afraid of conflict. I don't view it as conflict. I view it as solution solving, right? But we need to be transparent about those things. This is how you fix it, Mr. and Mrs. Entrepreneur. We will help you fix it. We will lead the round if we have to get the terms corrected. And that previous investor or set of investors aren't going to get what they thought they were going to get because it's actually not good for you or for them. They just don't know it. So that's one example. Or being proactive at the board level is another form of transparency. Being more proactive at the board level to when the company's running a cash burn that's too hot and there is a certain brick wall that's looming 6, 9, 12, 15 months away, to deal with those issues now. Does a company need to be recapped, right? So that it survives.
When you say recap, you mean recapitalized.
It could mean recapitalized. So it could mean a down round. So that what we've just been going through the last 2 or 3 years, all companies are struggling. It's really, well, I shouldn't say all, 90%. Most companies are struggling. And so proactively dealing with the looming issues, because problems never get better. They only get worse. So if you kick the can down the road or kind of play ostrich and put your head in the sand, that doesn't put you as an investor, your LPs, the entrepreneur, the co-founders, the employees, it doesn't put anybody in a better position. So just deal with the issues in a reasonable, responsible way. Collaboration. We just got to continually be careful not to let fiefdoms creep in. I was at your breakfast, the IBJ, the Engage Indiana series, the last one of the year. It was so powerful because people kept talking about speed and collaboration. And I love those two words. Those are really important words. Collaboration to me means not having a fiefdom mindset. And so let's really make sure we intentionally reach out to one another and work together. And one thing I talk about Elevate is we don't have to stand up more events. Let's see who else are running events around the state. Let's lean into those, make them more dense. So create more density, get more disparate stakeholders together more often by leaning in together with events around the state versus setting up new events that really aren't necessary.
Right. When you say fiefdom, is that another way of saying sort of like siloed?
Siloed. That's right.
Yeah. Just within the wider ecosystem.
Yep.
People are like, well, you know, we're the bioscience guys. And, well, those guys are the IoT guys.
Yeah.
And not allowed to talk.
That's right.
And not a lot of cooperation.
That's right. That cooperation, that communication, breaking down those silos is so powerful. Which, by the way, if looking back, starting the first tech company in 97 to today, our ecosystem and collaboration is just night and day different in a better way, exponentially better. And we can still do better, but we are definitely on a trajectory, on a path to do in the next 15 years what we did in the last 50 years.
One of the things that we always talk about at these events is workforce development. And you had a take that I thought was really interesting. And I don't know if you referred to it this way, but it kind of struck me as sort of the thing that that college coaches do, which is you're not identifying talent, you know, of kids who are in high school. You're identifying talent like K through eight. And number one, I don't even know how you would do that. But I mean, for people in whatever the various responsible sector is, to like look for, identify, and make contact with kids, I mean, who are less than teenagers.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
How do you do that?
So just like in sports, right? So historically, right, sports, they start off, you know, with seniors in high school, and they just kept going backwards. And now kids are getting recruited. They're watching kids at the junior high level. My son has friends.
There's like a Damon Bailey of coding out there right now who's like a fourth grader.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And they just go deeper, 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 deeper. The same thing is going to happen in all industries. It's already happening. And I think it started to happen with some companies who were very proactive in the trades, let's say. Which, by the way, there's really high-paying jobs in the trades. I have a friend who has an HVAC company. And you can make a great living working for his company right out of high school. And so what I'm so excited about is at the state level, from a policymaking standpoint, there are real discussions going on around how we disrupt our K-12 education. And so, you know, the old historical days of sitting in a row and everybody learning the exact same thing, those days are over. Now, to morph our education system to something that is more ecosystem built, that allows for a personalized journey based on someone's skill sets or interest level to move from A to B, that's going to be hard. We're going to make some mistakes. But it starts at the policymaking level, which is all in process right now. And so we are going to see a rapid acceleration of, let's just take the trades, for example, as a starter, where they start to go into the schools and offer apprenticeship opportunities, certification opportunities for some specialty. And that will naturally start at the high school level, and it will start working itself backwards. Google's already recruiting people in high school to not even go to college and just go straight to Google. because they've got the brain capacity to do whatever it is that they're doing, right? In AI or development or whatever. We're also going to see a major shift at what we know historically as computer science. So it used to be you banging around. Remember the old basic days or COBOL or Fortran? And now we're moving to modern day tools where you can stand up products without a lot of knowledge of how to actually code. Yeah. That's going to continue to accelerate. And so—
Well, and too, I was just from talking to the guys out there in our IT department, you know, they used to write all their code and now they're going to ChatGPT and saying, please make a code that does this.
That's right.
And bam, it's there.
Bam, it's there. Mm-hmm. A couple tweaks, you're in business. It is insane. And so I'm trying to remember the group. Sagamore had an event last year and I wish I could remember the group name that came in, but they showed over the last like 20 years, the top 10 jobs, the most sought after skill sets over the last 20 years. And then in the next 20 years, developers were number one. They're moving to last. The people who know how to leverage tools to do things more efficiently, I can't remember what the word they used for that, went from nearly last, like it was like in the high teens, to number one. Huh. And that's a transformation we're going to see. But we will see tech companies start to move in to the high schools. And even if those kids go to college, to start recruiting those kids. And we might even see people paying for certain people's college on some kind of a scholarship basis or whatever, but you're gonna agree to come work with us for whatever, four years, 5 years. What we will start to see similar things that happen in sports happen in the tech industry.
I'm gonna conditionally say that sounds great.
it's so exciting. I mean, you think with the transformation of that.
Yeah.
It's gonna transform lives. And that's why with the governor's initiative, right, to get broadband to every home throughout the state. These things, I just got chills. These things are so critical and important and powerful. Our next unicorns are living on a farm somewhere in Indiana. The talent comes from everywhere.
Yeah, I forget. Is it BEAD? That's the acronym for this program. Essentially, it's like $850 million from the feds, basically, to make sure everybody in the state has access to decent broadband.
Yes.
And we've been talking about this for, 20 years.
And now
this is like by far the biggest pot of money that has ever been in a state implemented for that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think AT&T just finished two counties somewhere in Indiana. I can't remember what two counties it was, but two counties they just finished. And I think there's broadband to every home in those two counties.
Another thing that you talked about, speaking of acronyms, it's MELFO. And the question was, what separates the entrepreneurs who get a yes from potential investors from the ones who get a no? And then you went into MELFO. What is MELFO?
Yes. So the concept here is, it is the entrepreneur's job to de-risk the investment for the investor, make it easier for the investor to say yes. The investor will never de-risk your business, right? So that's why you're the founder or the co-founder or the CEO. And so I always say the facts are good enough. Don't try to embellish a market size, a hockey stick revenue growth. Stick with the facts. The facts are always good enough. That translates into this concept called MELFO. So M equals market, E equals entrepreneur, L is legal, F is financial, O is operational. In each of these buckets, and these apply to every single stage, they change a little bit.
Right. And when you're evaluating companies,
this is what we're thinking about.
Right. You've got a sheet of paper in front of you, maybe, or a pad, who knows what you're doing, with a MELFO on it. And you're like, yeah. Each one of these five things you're evaluating.
You're evaluating.
Okay. Here's how they are in this one. So what are they?
So market is there a specific pain point that needs a solution that has created some level of proven market demand? Now it's going to get more robust as you go on. But at that very initial stage, even pre-rev, did you even go talk to anybody? Do you have an email, letter of intent, or have you done anything to prove pain, solution, and a product and a proven demand? Now it's going to get more robust again as you progress through the life of the company. But that's number one.
I'm just going to mention this because this is the one that I remember. Max Yoder of Lessonly has, I think he's been on the podcast before to talk about this. He has a great story about how he drained all his blood, sweat, and tears to create his first product. and didn't ask anybody beforehand, didn't ask anybody whether or not they thought it was useful.
Yep.
And it crashed and burned.
Yep.
And that was one of the great learning experiences of his early career.
It's so true. So true. Because you become so passionate about it. It's so obvious to you as an entrepreneur. And then E is entrepreneur or team. So do you have the skill sets to solve that pain? And now this is a little subjective, but one thing I think is really important for founders to think about, the two most important things with any idea or company is, do you have the ability to make the thing and to sell the thing? Those are critical. And so if you have the ability to sell the thing, go find someone who can help you build the thing. And there are companies are that do outsource the building of the thing initially. That can work, but if you can get a co-founder that matches the skill set you don't have, so out of the gate, being able to sell and make the thing, and maybe it's even more important to sell a thing because there's people who sell stuff that doesn't exist all the time, and then you got to go build it, right? But that's critical. That's number two. Number three is legal. So
legal hygiene, I think, was the
legal hygiene,
which I like.
Legal hygiene. So we see companies all the time that have created a rat's nest of legal scenarios. One example I'm going to use is this little thing called a safe. And
I'm glad you mentioned this because I was confused by this at the event.
So safes were invented by a company that does high volume of investments every year. They write many $150,000, I call them lottery tickets. I believe, and I don't know this for a fact, but the stuff I've read about the folks that invented the safe, actually it was a person that invented the safe. It was basically a vehicle to simplify their internal process of writing these checks. They'd write a bunch of $150,000 checks, and those companies would either be dead or alive in 18 months. They're either going to raise money or not. And if they don't, they're probably dead. Hmm. And so it was an easier way for them to execute and cut down on a bunch of process, et cetera, writing these $150,000 checks. Objectively, I can understand why a company might do that. And SAFE stands for Simple Agreement for Equity. What happened is people started using these safes in all kinds of different, and by the way, the safe was only meant for an event, one-time funding, any event, one investor, one time.
Wow. Which is invented just for this one,
situation. One situation. Right. That is the entire intent. It's morphed into safes are founder friendly. You know, it's one piece of paper. And it's morphed into phased investing. So people are stacking these safes on top of each other over a period of years in some situations. They all have different caps. They've invented this thing called a post safe, which means, I'll just say number one, founders, you are getting diluted more by these safes when you stack them on top of each other. And if you have an option pool, it even makes it worse because all that conversion has to happen at each stage. When you convert into your priced equity round, you are getting diluted more than if you had just used cash. And this is the first time I've ever said this publicly, but cash stands for convertible agreements save headaches. So convertible notes, tried and true, been around forever. Everybody knows what they are. They have caps. They have discounts. There is interest, but they are, when those are converted into equity at a price round, the dilution happens collectively. And so that's just number one. From a founder-friendly standpoint, founders, you're getting diluted more.
That sounds way easier.
It's way easier. So that number one is that founder-friendly is this dilution issue. That is not founder-friendly. Number two, people say they save money. I've yet to see that. A couple things. Number one, typically when you're doing safes with anybody that has some level of investing sophistication, you're always redlining that safe. That's always happened. There's red lines happening in that safe. Oh, I need to set a side letter to address this other issue. So you're still going through these motions of appeasing things that weren't addressed in the initial safe. So I don't think it saves money. Let's say it does. I'm going to give the benefit of the doubt at the time of moment of investing. Let's say it does save $2,000. When you go to convert into the priced equity round, the legal work involved in unwinding those safes and getting them all to convert, you at least double your legal bill at that stage, at minimum. So not only did you get diluted more, you're also paying a lot more in legal fees to unwind the rat's nest that was built. From the investor side, what is a safe? It's not debt. It's not equity. It's an IOU. So remember in like, you know, elementary school, you might write an IOU to your friend. I owe you 2 pieces of candy. That's basically what a safe is. And I know I'm getting a little rough on safes here at the moment, but like, that's how I think about it. So are we in the business of writing IOUs? So let's say, now let's give a little benefit of the doubt and say, well, maybe it's a grant. Well, there are foundations out there that write grants. So are VCs foundations and grant writers, or are they investors? If the LPs knew what these VCs were doing with these safes, I think they would have a little concern.
Yeah. Let's move on. Because we still need to do FOE.
Yes. Financial. So financial, that comes up. Financial hygiene is a believable business model. Having your data from day one tracked into very specific structured data buckets. Understanding unit economics. Don't show a hockey stick for the sake of showing a hockey stick. You know, growing at 50% year over year right now is amazing. You don't have to show that you're going to grow 100-125%. Because if you come in at 60%, you're going to be a villain. If you say I'm going to grow 50%, you come at 55 or 60%, you're a hero. So financial hygiene. O is operational. And so this gets into like go-to-market strategy. So a lot of times I'll hear companies say, our go-to-market strategy is PLG and enterprise and channel partners. PLG stands for product-led growth. Enterprise are typically at least one, if not 2 or 3 year contracts. And those are big ticket contracts, 6-figure, 7-figure contracts. Channel partners are, I'm going to work with someone who's going to sell my product. These are three very different strategies that many companies never get to all three, and they do great. So understand operationally your go-to-market strategy and not overextend yourself, because you will never get venture capital investment if you're trying to execute. This is just one example, but execute those three strategies at one time. Pick a strategy.
We have a couple minutes left. I wanted to ask you, again, more Elevate specific. Speaking of disruption, it sounds like you guys are really interested in moving from your current location. Is it still on 91st Street?
Yes.
Okay.
91st and Meridian.
Right. Downtown to the Mile Square. What's the thinking there?
So we are really excited. We've been working on a lot of things behind the scenes for the last nearly 2 years at Elevate since I arrived. So I call this the year of manifestation, Elevate 3.0. It's going to manifest itself in three stages. The first stage is going to be digital manifestation. People are going to see a whole new look and feel, how we talk about ourselves, copy, how you interact, et cetera. That'll happen mid-April, mid-May. Phase two is the physical manifestation. We need to be in the middle of the innovation ecosystem. And so we are going to be moving our offices downtown. We're really excited about it. We looked heavily at various places around central Indiana. So Launch Fishers, we looked at 16 Tech, we looked at Bottle Works, we even looked in Zionsville. And what's really critical for Indiana, so we have intentional connectivity throughout all corners of the state, but our downtown being robust is just critical. And so we didn't see a spot that's activating the innovation ecosystem that's downtown proper, Mile Square. Walkable to the Circle, walkable to the stadiums. And so that's where we're planning to go. We're really excited about it. We're going to set our office up. We'll have some outdoor space in terms of a balcony. Next to us, we're going to have a community event training area, also a partner area to really foster collaboration when people are downtown. And in the third phase is operational excellence that we don't have time to get into. But we're really excited about moving the office in a very vibrant community.
Okay. And we can't talk yet about where you're going to be, but you do have a place that you're zeroing in on.
Yes. LOI is signed, and we just got to get that lease signed.
Okay.
As soon as the lease is signed, we're ready to talk about it.
Okay. Well, good. Well, we'll have to check in here in about a year and see how this all goes. But and hopefully we'll see you more downtown.
Awesome. Thanks, Mason. It was awesome to be here.
Appreciate it, Tom.
My thanks again to Christopher today. And folks, before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few stories in the latest edition of IBJ I want to draw to your attention. First up, Indianapolis has a case of Caitlin Clark fever, and local basketball fans hope she'll be a massive headache for WNBA teams for many years to come. As IBJ's Mickey Shuey reports, Clark could be the balm for what ails the Indiana Fever franchise, which is widely expected to pick Clark in the league draft, and an elixir for all of Indianapolis. Also in this week's paper, Dave Lindquist explains why craft beer, once a prime driver of Indy's food and beverage scene, is no longer a growth industry. And Susan Orr provides a peek at how area businesses seek to capitalize on April the 8th's total eclipse. And again, you can find these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ, or you can find them online at IBJ.com. And thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.